Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 175 on passive real estate investing in real estate developments and how to build retirement income with Mike Brown. If you're into real estate investing and building wealth, congratulations, you are in the right place. The REI Diamond Show is a wide-ranging conversation of all things real estate investing. My goal here is to invite high-caliber guests who specialize in building wealth, such as real estate investors and other industry service providers, and then draw out the jewels of wisdom, those tactics, mindsets, and methods used to create millions of dollars and more in the business of real estate. And today I'm here with Mike Brown, the founder of Red Fox Wealth and Red Fox Capital. Mike is an accomplished real estate developer with a CCIM designation who has a focus on industrial and commercial real estate, ground up or investments, including retail, with project sizes anywhere from a few million dollars up to $40 million. We cover topics including how COVID has impacted the commercial real estate sector, wealth management for various levels of investors, and a few favorite assets and portfolios Mike is currently assembling. Please enjoy our conversation. All right, Mike Brown, welcome to the REI Diamond Show. How are you doing today?
Good. Thanks, Dan. Glad to be here.
Yeah, for sure. So let's begin with the Red Fox Capital creation story. What does your business look like today, and how did you arrive here?
Well, we've been in the commercial real estate investing space for nearly 20 years. Started out as a commercial real estate brokerage and development company, mostly building industrial and office product, and morphed now into full investment company where we establish private commercial real estate funds for investors. And we simply go out, build portfolios, create passive income for our clients, and create wealth.
All right. So you are not only managing money, but it sounds like your company is also actively involved in constructing these even to this day, right, Mike?
We do. We do ground up construction development if we see opportunities. It doesn't fit all of our clients' profile. Some clients like a guaranteed, you know, dividend, cash flow check, income producing right out of the gate. So any investors who are looking for more of a long, more of a value add payout, we would put them into a development project. So we have kind of a toolkit of investments for everybody's particular taste.
Yeah, that's interesting. So how did that end up morphing? I mean, it kind of makes sense. We have a lot of people on the show over the years who do apartment syndications, office syndications, and they kind of fit the box more so of syndicating investments, and like, this is the investment that I have, and it sounds like you sort of started that way. About how long ago, and how did you make the transition to start adding in what we might call like more conventional Wall Street style investments to kind of serve the clientele? It sounds like you put more of a wealth management spin here for your client as opposed to just staying in the lane of the commercial real estate, right?
Well, absolutely. We actually have two divisions. We have a Red Fox Wealth, which is our wealth management firm. And we take an approach we call integrated portfolio management. So we're able to take an investment client who may have a traditional Wall Street profile and show them how to incorporate private real estate investing into their portfolio and reduce their risk, create more of a diversified portfolio for them, and raise their returns. So it's a holistic approach. And we found in the past there were a lot of conflicts of interest among investment advisors where they felt like they would tell you that you were completely diversified, but in reality, you were diversified only in Wall Street products. So we tried to open up our clients' eyes to There's other avenues to be truly diversified across asset classes. And we've taken that out to the market and had great response.
So, Mike, you mentioned the certain type of investor, kind of two types, if you will. You had a type one investor, we'll call them for the sake of our conversation, that is kind of needing the dividend on day one. And I'm assuming that's probably REITs or certain, you know, Wall Street style investments versus someone who is interested in the value add and the longer payout. In your experience, is the longer payout with the delay in the beginning of the actual distributions, is that usually going to perform at a higher return, or is there really no way of knowing on that on a consistent basis?
It will typically, most likely pay a higher return, since there's more risk involved in new construction, that the investor and everyone involved should have a higher payout. So, knowing that and knowing that if we're going through a new construction project, you could have 2 years of dead space while we're going through entitlement and construction and leasing up or selling out the building. So the cash flow then accrues during the fund, and then we start to pay it out as we occupy the particular building. And then once it's sold out, there's a large windfall back to the investor. And then on the income producing, more of a stabilized asset with established cash flow, our investors are usually paid a 9% preferred return. So they're getting that mailbox money. And then as we sell the portfolio, they'll have a windfall. And typically on the income producing, to give you an idea, would pay out around a 15% internal rate of return on average, go up a couple points, depending on performance. And then development, new construction, we would like to see at least a 20% or higher internal rate of return.
All right. And we were talking right before we turned on the recorder here, and I was surprised you said that you didn't do multifamily. And it feels like from my perspective here, I'm hosting the show, it's probably weighted more toward the apartment investing community. I mean, we're residential real estate investors mostly, Mike. So I think naturally, the person who's buying a single family house and renting it feels like a natural progression to buy a 3-flat, 4-flat, 10 flat, maybe then 100 unit building, 200. So it seems this natural progression from the world that I and most of the listeners probably come in. So I was a little surprised that wasn't right. And it's cool because we have the experience that you bring to the table right now of this other development that we don't hear a lot about. Can you maybe touch on, how the focus on the specific asset classes you work on in real estate development and operating and how come you focus there? And then maybe kind of put a bow on that with the most recent deal that you had put together.
Yeah, I think, I really started in commercial real estate and heavy industrial. So I started there. And we never, a boutique firm where I kind of did my apprenticeship and learned the business. We never went into the multifamily side. And I think they're just commercial real estate and real estate in general is a complex business. And there are special skills, for each asset class. And multifamily is competitive. There are a lot of players. So we just never went there. We've done hotels, but never in apartments or multifamily. So starting out in heavy industrial and in industrial class, we would do investment deals where you would see a manufacturing plant or one of my first deals was a heavy crane construction company. And then we started moving into saw space to build and construct a small industrial flex space where you would have, a small contractor like you're like a pesticide control a company where they would need drive-in bays for their trucks and then also have a small office component. And then we moved into a lot of office space, which today is we've been bearish on office space for some time now. So staying away from general office. But we see some opportunities in retail, small regional shopping centers without anchor tenants are prime for great repositioning, we think, next year. And we've already are starting to put those on the map as COVID works through the economy. There could be some great opportunities there. And currently, we are building a portfolio of Dollar General stores and acquiring the stores one-off and combining those stores into a portfolio to create even more safety for the investor. And those are all corporate guaranteed by Dollar General. And we're able to pay out a really nice return. So, you know, we've kind of morphed into, you know, those different areas, land speculation and going through entitlements for fees. We still do that part of our business. But nothing wrong with the residential side. I think, you know, a lot of people, like you said, think that's the natural progression. Start with a home and then you build your way up. I think you can, if you are not an operator or decide not to be an operator, but more of a passive investor, you leverage our expertise and you can just enjoy the benefits of real estate investing without the day-to-day grind.
Gotcha. So it feels like to me, when I think of commercial from more of the residential mindset, I am like with Dollar General as an example, the reality is my risk is probably a little more weighted on the tenant themselves. So in a sense, it's like I am, if I'm building this portfolio of Dollar General, and correct me, you know, when I'm done, if I'm wrong, but I'm kind of taking a bet on the company and I'm believing in the company and what they're doing versus, oh, it's just a cap rate and it's just a certain amount of income coming in. That's great. And that's kind of how a multifamily deal is. Like you're not, you know, weighing the risk of each one of your tenants and the jobs they have. You may at some point, you know, depending on the price of the rent, you're dealing with people who might be working in higher level income jobs or lower level income jobs. And maybe there's some risk there, but it's not like this individualized, you know, thing with Dollar General. And Dollar General sounds to me, following the trends in the economy over the last decade or so, we're seeing such a shrinking of, you know, middle America and, you know, the lower end of the market, the lower income business like Dollar General, they're kicking ass, for lack of a better term, out there. Because yeah,
well said.
You know, it's a shame because it's, you know, at the same time, it's like the middle America is sort of shrinking, but that's going to, you know, a larger base of, you know, Dollar General customers. And hopefully we're able to see that trend reverse a little bit. But I don't think that's going to negate the growth of Dollar General. Right. So that risk on the tenant,
they're actually in expansion mode right now. But, you know, going back to what you're saying, I mean, the tenant definitely is the most important. And what we like about the Dollar General specifically is that the publicly held company, Dollar General, guarantees the leases for all the buildings on 10-year lease terms. So that's pretty good.
As long as the company is good, that's good, right?
Yep, and the company's solid. Absolutely.
Cool. So I think I noticed that you are CCIM certified. Am I saying that right, Mike?
Yep, that's correct.
Can you define that for the listeners? I think it's a valid stamp of approval on experience, if you will, of the commercial real estate business. And I think anybody who was looking to get into it would like to know what that is.
Sure. CCIM stands for Certified Commercial Investment Member. You have to go through a rigorous academic curriculum. And then you have to have so many years and so much business volume that's documented. And then you prepare a portfolio. You go in front of a panel to actually get your credentials and take, I think it was an 8-hour exam where we flew out to California, took an exam for 8 hours. The last I heard, the top 5% of commercial real estate practitioners hold a designation. And it really goes into some serious depth on commercial real estate investing and the analysis around investing. So it was a great education. And anybody out there looking to do commercial real estate investing should look for a CCIM designated professional.
And how much, you know, over your career looking back, right, if you could say, mm-hmm. like, you know, a certain percentage, I learned a certain percentage from doing the CCIM and I learned a certain percentage from doing the business. And I imagine they both went hand in hand in the experience that came along with mentors and partners and actually doing deals is probably more value. But, you know, how much of that could you allocate to the actual educational content and investment that came through the CCIM designation?
Well, I always think experience is the best way to learn the business, and commercial real estate and even residential. I mean, it's every deal's a little bit different. And you have to be able to adapt and understand that, the different variables. But, you know, the CCIM prepared a solid foundation for a true way to analyze an asset that you can't get from experience. It's really a step above strictly just out trading deals and putting deals together. So it rounded out our education. And, you know, it's not for everybody, but if you want to get into – you know, more sophisticated way to break apart an opportunity. That foundation was great.
Perfect. So let's talk about passive real estate investing specifically. And we kind of touched on this a little bit, but how do you advise clients interested in investing in real estate without the oversight and work involved in direct ownership of properties?
Well, I think, you know, there are a couple ways. Like you mentioned earlier, if you just want to buy into a REIT stock, you know, real estate investment trust, that's fine. It's not my favorite, because it's correlated to Wall Street. So it's truly not, diversified away from the street. So, I think as a passive investor, I think the smartest way to do is, you could syndicate, with a sponsor that has experience. You could syndicate with your friends and family to take on a project. Or you could look for, you know, professional investment companies like ourselves, where you can look at a guy who's got experience, got a track record, and safely invest your money and have it managed for you, and turns out to just be mailbox money.
Yeah, and one of the things as I asked the question, I'm thinking to myself, you know, we have people who raise their hand. They go to fundrehabdeals.com. That's our internal passive investor, you know, our money list. So when we have a project, we email it to that list. It's accredited investors only. But the barrier to entry for that, my last one, Mike, it was $200,000. I sent it out. I got the text back. You know, it's funded. It's fine. But a lot of people don't necessarily start with $200,000. And if you're starting with $2,000, you can actually get into maybe some of the REITs and stuff like that. So like Wall Street offers this like lower barrier to entry, especially with Robinhood and TD and, you know, commission-free trades. And you can start playing in the investment space with much lower money. But I would think, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that's probably a higher amount, right, to play in some of these because you have to be accredited. But how would you invest $100,000 in real estate today, Mike?
Well, we our minimums are typically $100,000. But for anybody, you know, with a lower entry point, could look at some crowdfunding sites, you know, like Fundrise, or they're more and more popping up every day. And those allow individuals who are not accredited to invest smaller amounts into a project. So I think that is probably the easiest way to get in at a lower investment amount without and still staying with the guidelines of true passive investing.
I'm interested in what your opinion is on these different funding things. So we have like kind of the Bitcoin tokenization of assets right now, and we have the crowdfunding. And on the flip side of that, there's the SEC regulations about accredited investors and people being savvy enough to understand the risks that they're involved in putting their money in. What's your personal opinion on that, if any, Mike? Like, have they kind of jeopardized people and put people at risk? Do you think this is a good thing overall? The trend of this, you know, tokenization of properties has no regulation at all at this point.
Yeah, I think, you know, Bitcoin, I see a lot of the younger investors enjoy just the thrill of trading it. I don't quite know where that's going, but I think on the crowdfunding site, some of the downside that we see are deals that are never funded, where they have such a high threshold to get the deal completed, and they're taking, you know, smaller amounts and never gets across the finish line. You know, the regulation, you know, if you bring in, as you well know, non-accredited investors, you're held at a little higher standard, so you need to audit your financials, and you're, as an operator, you're at more risk. When you have somebody come in that's less sophisticated, maybe not understand the process, could have some snags. We've decided internally not to go into the non-accredited space, and simply for the reason we like the more sophisticated investors that have larger amounts to invest. But there's a place for everybody at the table. I think you just need to do your due diligence with either the operator or the crowdfunding source and make sure that you're protected.
Yeah, and it brings up one of my own experiences that took place. So I started out like completely flat broke, you know, failed at life. And early on, it was like anybody that was willing to invest was like this godsend. And I remember I took $5,000 from a guy. I didn't even have a deal to put it in. I didn't know what to do with it. The guy wanted to invest. I said, okay, fine, you know, give me the $5,000. I did find a deal. I put it in there. But then I had this experience of he's calling me and it's locked up in this deal, right, that I'm in the middle of doing. He's calling me, wants his money back right now in a panic. And, you know, right. The lesson is not everyone that's going to give you money is a good idea, right? It's just easy early on if that's the only person that's you and willing to take any kind of a bet to maybe take the money. But, you know, hey, there's sometimes going to be aggravation. And the non-accredited investors and the people with like less money are going to get, in some cases, probably not across the board, much more emotional and have these knee-jerk reactions and panics, especially in light of things like, you know, over the course of December 2020 as we record, the panics that we've had this year coming and going. Speaking of which, Mike, how has this year been? Commercial real estate, retail, you know, the headlines are the headlines. Everyone knows what they are. But like, what is your... how did you guys sail through 2020? And, you know, we talked a bit about what you expect next year, but how has this current year been for you guys, Mike?
Well, it's been a struggle. I think, you know, in the beginning of the lockdown earlier spring, we had some assets under contract and decided to get out of those contracts. We saw the lenders getting a bit sketchy on how to put valuations on assets. And we're starting to see things. There's some activity going now. We've had some people retreat after the presidential election, where individuals don't want to expand their businesses or investors are concerned about capital gain treatment. So the political environment's definitely gone against us, at least personally. So I think there's going to be some opportunities. I think some of the things that we see will be opportunities, just haven't gotten through the cycle yet. They need to get to more pain, and the lenders need to start loosening up and letting these guys free. So it's been quiet. There's been people kicking the can, but I think it'll be a good next year, I hope.
You said 20 years. So do you remember about how long? 2008, right? In the fall? All hits the fan and the headlines were everywhere. How long was it until any commercial real estate deals came to cycle through after the 2008 headlines happened?
Yeah. That was an historical moment. As you know, on the residential side, it was great because the lenders were willing to do short sales and negotiate modified loans. So there's tons of transactions. On the commercial side, it was the opposite. The banks, the lenders, were not willing to do that. And the assets were larger and they prefer to kick the can and wait for it to, cycle out. And we literally saw, you know, 2 to 3 years, where we were in limbo. And it was a very tough time. But those market shifts are good because it washes out a lot of the less capitalized, inexperienced players. But it was, you know, speaking back to guys who had been in the business, you know, even back in the 70 recession, they're like, we've never seen something like this. It was a tough time.
Do you expect that same 2 to 3 year cycle of kicking the can right now in commercial real estate?
I don't think it will be this time around. I think, you know, there were a lot of lessons learned, and I certainly, you know, you never know, but I don't project it to be as bad as we saw back in the 2007-08 cycle.
Agreed. Do you what's the average deal size for you guys when you're typically putting together development, repositioning, one of the kind of longer term deals that we were mentioning earlier?
I'd say typical small regional shopping centers that we put into portfolios range from $5 to $8 million per center. Some of the portfolios we like to stay between $10 and $20 million, and ground up new construction development projects are typically capitalized around the $30 to $40 million range.
Gotcha. Any projects under contract right now, Mike?
Only in the Dollar General side. We're waiting for everything else for first, second quarter of next year.
And yeah, I think a lot of us are hanging tight here right now. So I have a scenario. We'll shift gears here a little bit. Let's put on the wealth management hat. We'll play with a little example here. So let's say we have a client, 60 years old. They want to retire at 65. They've made $100,000 per year. They've paid off the primary residence, and they have little debt and no other hard assets except cash, right? Your goal is they show up on your door, Mike, and they say, okay, what's the amount of cash that I'd need now at 60 to be ready to retire by 65, assuming the same lifestyle as that 100K a year that we were talking about? And then number two, how would you invest that amount of cash to meet the retirement date of 65 years old?
Yeah. So, you know, every client's different. So what we would do is sit down with them and have a nowadays a Zoom call or a phone call and kind of do a little discovery, find out, you know, what their goals are in retirement. And we have software that we can project what that income looks like and where you need to be, and then re-engineer it to how we get to those goals. So it really depends on the particular person, what investable assets they have to structure. It's not really a one-size-fits-all. I hate to give you a short answer, but depends on the client and their risk tolerance and suitability for certain investments. But we can certainly, you know, sit down with the client and engineer that for them and show them a path to hit their retirement income goals. If real estate's a part of that, then we'll certainly expose them to that. But it just depends on the individual.
If we had to throw a number at that, right? So like how much cash they need. If it was $1 million in cash, is that enough? Do they need $2 million, $3 million to throw off $100,000 a year in, you know, passive income? They need $100,000 a year to live, right? We'll just keep it simple. Forget about all the tax differences that actually would occur in reality. But if you had to throw a dart and hit the number, would it be $1 million, $500K, $10 million? What would it be?
You know, like, probably at least $1 million. You know, it depends on their, you know, Social Security. You got to put that into the puzzle. But I would say that's probably a good place to start. And, you know, look at, you know, life insurance structures. You've probably heard of the private banking tools out there where you can use those to grow wealth and do estate planning and long-term care issues. So there's a lot of different multiple facets to it. But typically, you know, people do like to lower their income in retirement. But I have others that want to increase their income in retirement. So we, you know, you're not going to hit that with $500,000 probably, in assets, but, you know, so we may have to put a growth component to it, which would raise the risk profile. So, you know, once again, it goes back to suitability and the risk tolerance of the individual.
Have you ever had investors call in a panic in 2008, 2009, you know, in March this year? If so, how have you talked them off the ledge, Mike?
Well, I've never had anyone call me in panic. You know, we take every client and, you know, really explain to them all the different scenarios. But, you know, that being said, the illiquidity of real estate can sometimes be your best friend, because you're not going to have the panic selling where an individual sees the market dip 400 points and tries to go in and sell everything in a panic and then be tremendously harmed. So the illiquidity of real estate can sometimes be their best friend, where they don't have that option, and we can talk them through that. But, you know, we typically, you know, have clients that, you know, a dip in the market or, you know, any kind of anomaly it's not going to affect them too much. And they're savvy enough to know, we'll get through this and, get back on top. Now we could, you know, reposition the client into, a defensive moment, or we could, you know, put them in stop losses, on the market. We could put them into annuity products. We could put them into options, any kind of sophisticated trading, to take the peaks, but protect their downside. So, you know, it depends on the client.
Yeah, and I imagine, like, the more affluent the investor is and the further along in life, they probably dealt with some hiccups. I mean, I'm 40 years old now, and I've gone through a couple of them, obviously, myself. I started with Zip Zero, right? Broke, like I was telling you, an embarrassingly small place that I started with. I've had real estate be my friend when I own it and don't sell it and hang on to it and had those kind of gains. I've had those moments where the stock market gyrated and I panic sold a little bit, and other times where I kind of held fast, foolishly maybe. But one of the things I know for me, real estate investor, like I flip a lot of houses. We did 247 this year so far, and we're probably going to close at least another maybe 20, 25 before the end of the year. And we lost money on some of those deals. Luckily, the money losing deals didn't happen on the first or second deal in my career. And I always kind of like, not really advise, but I share my own experience in, look, I'm going to lose money on some deals. And the best thing I can do is do a whole bunch of more deals behind that to kind of offset that. So I treat my single family house flipping business in my own mindset as the same way that maybe stock market picking would occur, where, look, I got three or four winners and this one's like a giant loser and then this one's kind of like breaking even. That's what happens on my flips. And it, you know, for me to emotionally grow past that loser, I mean, you know, to have that moment of panic when we're losing money on a deal won't sell, and, you know, we're five or six figures upside down in said deal, it's not a great place to be. But the thing that makes it palatable for me is making sure to continue forward, you know, making the right actions day by day and not remain paralyzed by that fear.
Right, exactly. It's you never want to fall in love with a deal, you know, and you just got to keep moving. You know, it's a numbers game, you know, and that's kind of why we build larger portfolios. So if, you know, with sensitivity testing to see if there is a loser, we try to run those stress tests at the absolute worst scenario. So we can mitigate those issues. It's real estate. We're all in business cycles. So it's going to happen. And timing the market is a very difficult, if not impossible, thing to do.
Yeah, you're right about that. So we didn't nail down a location, which I normally do for my guests and for the listeners early. So with the location nailing down for you, Mike, would you also touch on some of your favorite markets around the U.S.?
Yeah, sure. So I'm based in Virginia. We are in the Washington, D.C. suburbs. We do business all around the country. We're doing a deal in South Dakota right now, an industrial deal. And I have wealth management clients around the country, East Coast, West Coast. I think some of the best markets are where the population's going. So, you know, the Southeast, you know, is a no-brainer. As people are running away from high tax states into the South and Texas, you know, so, but that brings inherent problems itself. We're seeing overvaluations and things like that. So, we like, secondary and tertiary markets. So, you know, maybe the outskirts of one of those, metropolitan areas where we start seeing still some value there. So, you know, we're kind of agnostic as far as anywhere we prefer to go, but I would say anywhere in the Southeast is our preferable markets right now.
Nice. My last guest was Greg Cohn, and he was from Jacksonville, and he does like turnkey single family rental properties. And I was so excited to have him on the show for that exact reason. It's like anywhere in the Southeast, like my Atlanta market, we just see the values ratchet so much quicker and so much higher than Chicago and Philadelphia, where we also are. And those markets still also have been keeping pace, but they were, seemed like they came online later and slower, you know, Philadelphia and Chicago versus Atlanta. And Atlanta's property tax structure is so low that it's mind-blowing compared to Chicago and Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, we're starting to see opportunities back up. You know, we're looking at Pennsylvania now. So it really depends on what you're looking to do. Like single-family flipping is very difficult in our market. It's the properties are so expensive. There's very little movement right now. If you do get a listing, it's going to have multiple offers, and it's tough to operate in your climate around us right now.
Yeah, it makes sense. So going into 2020, what are the best tax strategies for high income earners in 2020 when they file their taxes next year?
Well, I think, you know, that's kind of a loaded question considering the fact that we all think taxes are going to be going up.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I had a client this morning that we are converting his IRA. He has a self-directed IRA that holds some of his single family home properties, investment properties. And he is moving that into a Roth IRA. So he's elected, let's pay the tax bill now on the gamble that taxes are going to be going up. So we're seeing a lot of Roth conversions this time of year. We're seeing people look at going into index universal life policies. So they're trying to create that tax-free income into the future. And we're seeing, you know, a real tax conscious, you know, climate right now, knowing that we're probably going to see a pretty difficult environment with, you know, we're at a $27 trillion debt nation right now. You know, trying to position yourself for tax-free income in retirement is really the number one thing on the talking block.
Bear with me. I'm taking some notes there. Well, that is an interesting perspective. Is there anything you've done personally, action items here, to try to reposition for the coming potential tax changes?
As far as the real estate side goes, there's really not much we can do. You know, we're concerned about the carried interest position because that's kind of how, as sponsors, we kind of take our money as carried interest, as ordinary tax gain treatment. So that's something kind of out of our hands. Moving into situations where we can personally create tax-free income using those products that I mentioned before was what I'm doing personally and on the wealth management side with clients, high net worth clients. But I think, you know, it's hang on and see what happens over the next 4 years.
Would you mind defining the carried interest position?
Sure. So, for example, this is probably more noticeable in the hedge fund community. But we're similarly set up in private equity as kind of a hedge fund where typically a sponsor will manage a fund, whether it be private equity, stock trading, or real estate. And typically it's an asset management fee that covers the day-to-day. But the real money, the real compensation for the sponsor is at the end when the large profits come as the windfall. And when those profits come into the sponsor, they are taxed at ordinary income, as capital gains tax, not ordinary income. So you often hear that Warren Buffett's secretary pays more in taxes than he does. And that's because his income is really derived from capital gains treatment. So, you know, he's at 15%. She may be at at 25-30% tax treatment. So carried interest is a fancy word for describing that, if that makes sense to you.
Gotcha. And so are they kind of talking about converting that to ordinary income? And that's kind of the fear right now?
Yes. And, you know, it's always been on the chopping block and talking about it. But I think we're at a even more realistic chance of it happening now. And it would really make a huge impact in the private equity, hedge fund, real estate space.
Gotcha. Glad I asked. So, Mike, what would be the What would be the two books you'd recommend most often?
Other than my book?
Well, you might as well include that one. So we could go
sure.
with three if you want.
Okay, great. You know, my book came out in September. It's called The Real Perspective, Secret Investments Your Financial Advisor Won't Tell You About. And anybody listening today, I'd be happy to give you a link where you can get a free download copy for free for all your listeners, Dan. But hard copies you can get on Amazon. And that talks about, you know, my experience taking an integrative portfolio management where we incorporate Wall Street investing in with private real estate investing and how you build portfolios around that. I am just finished reading Charles Schwab's latest autobiography. And I thought that was interesting, you know, seeing how he was a pioneer in the discount brokerage side. And I kind of feel similar to him trying to recreate the wealth management space. So I feel a kindred spirit there. And, you know, I'm always, you know, looking, I'm more of a history guy. So I love, you know, reading books on history and just finished reading Rebel Yell, which is an awesome biography on Stonewall Jackson. You probably
nice.
Haven't heard that one yet before.
No, those are both two new ones. I love the autobiographies. I love the biographies of business luminaries, and it's something that I enjoy more and more. So it's refreshing to kind of get that. And I feel like there's a way, you know, you talked about the kindred spirit when you're reading Charles Schwab's book. I feel like there's a method to read biographies for people who are yearning for evolution and greater success in maybe their business or in their life. And that's like, you know, we're not reading this as a history class assignment where we're going to have to answer the questions at the end. We're reading this with, okay, so, you know, what are the jewels of wisdom that I can extract from what Charles Schwab is doing and then insert that into my own business? And that's how I attend the podcast as the host with guests like yourself, Mike. And I learn a lot and I take notes and, you know, there's kind of a method to actually engaging in the learning process. And that would be like my little extra piece on the biographies, right?
Yeah, I think the life lesson is that, you know, all these guys went through huge hardships. I mean, they all had massive failures in their journey to success. And I don't trust anybody who's never had a setback. It's like they haven't really come to appreciate success, and they're overconfident. And I think that's the thing I love to read about business biographies.
Nice. So my final question that I ask all of the guests here, this is the REI Diamond Show. It's all about the jewels of wisdom. That said, let's talk about the crown jewel of wisdom. Mike, is there one thing you'd share with your younger self, or maybe one thing you wish you knew then that you know now?
Well, I tell you, I think two things. Every entrepreneur I speak to says they wish they started earlier. So I encourage the younger listeners to find your passion. Start now. Don't wait. And the other piece of advice that I wish I'd known is always be looking and reserving capital, because when you need it, there's opportunities. It's harder to find. And so always be overcapitalized if it's possible, and keep that mindset, because when the opportunities come, you need to be ready to move on it.
Nice. So how can listeners get more information about you?
Yeah.
You did talk about the book or Red Fox Capital or Wealth.
Yeah, two things. Redfoxwealth.com. Go on. You can download my book for free for your listeners. And redfoxcapital.co. We have some great white papers and information on private real estate and alternative investments for all the listeners. And if they have any questions or would like to talk about their individual situation, I'd be happy to offer a complimentary consultation with anybody.
All right, cool. Well, hey, we've reached the end, my friend. Mike, I appreciate it. I got a great perspective from the stuff we talked about on the show, so I really appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you.
Absolutely. It was great, Dan. You're a great interviewer, man.
Thanks, man. Do my best.
right. All right, buddy. Have a great weekend.
Low-cost capital is the fuel of any volume real estate investment business. As a real estate investor, I am sure you're well aware of these two facts. First, your business is driven by access to capital, or starved from a lack thereof. And two, you make more money when you reduce the cost of said capital. Whether you're looking for hard money loans to fix and flip houses, rental portfolio loans, or even a line of credit, Lending Home offers the most competitive rates in the market, currently as low as 6.49%, which is good for fix and flip single family loans. I pay 10% myself at fundrehabdeals.com to my private investors. So at 6.49%, if you like that interest rate, go to reilineofcredit.com. Even if you're not currently in the market for a loan at this very minute, I encourage you to still go through that 1 minute sign up process right now so you can get on the email list. That way, once you're ready and you have a deal or a few, their name is top of mind. Plus, as a bonus for signing up through reilineofcredit.com, you'll receive a free iPad when you close your first loan. That's reilineofcredit.com. And thanks again for tuning in. Remember to review and subscribe on your podcasting app. Just search REI Diamonds and click subscribe. You can also access the full archive of wealth-building real estate investment jewels of wisdom at reidiamonds.com. It's about 175 episodes there, reidiamonds.com. So my main business, Diamond Equity Investments, is that of buying, renovating, and selling houses. 223 bought and sold in 2019, and 260 houses bought and sold so far in 2020. We currently have another 115 houses in our inventory, either under construction, for sale, or sold and awaiting closing. So here's how you and I can do business. Number one, before we begin construction, we offer our houses for sale at wholesale pricing. If you'd like access to those real estate deals, please go to www.accessrealestatedeals.com. Number two, if you're an accredited investor, you also enjoy double-digit returns on your capital and would consider potentially funding passively a deal of mine or many deals, go to fundrehabdeals.com and you can sign up to receive private mortgage investment opportunity emails. Number three, I buy houses that need renovation, and I buy apartment buildings that are stable with below market rents in the metropolitan Atlanta, Chicago, and Philadelphia regions. Please email me details if you have a deal for sale. And number four, currently, we have a fourth option. If you are an A player and would like to be considered as a potential member of the Diamond Equity team, please go to dealswithroi.com/careers. We are at the conclusion. Do you know why the land flipping market itself has become super heated? Next up, the land geek and high volume land dealer, Mark Podolsky, joins us again on the REI Diamond Show to share the reasons why land in the United States is in extremely high demand. Catch you next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.